Gators Breakdown, the Gators fan podcast, because there's never a dull moment in Gator Nation.
The Gators Breakdown podcast is ready to go. I'm your host, David Waters, and you can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC, and spring ball is right around the corner. So for this episode, of course, is joining me Will Miles from his site readandreaction.com and on Twitter at WillMilesSEC. Will, just a couple of weeks away from spring practice, of course, and teased it last week, but we're going to be doing some spring previews here and answering some of our viewer, listener, Twitter follower questions that were sent in. So a lot to break down and look forward to in this episode of Gators Breakdown as we preview spring football.
Yeah, man, it's March. It was 60 degrees up here in Pennsylvania today, and it's getting a little bit warm. It's time to get ready to go, man. So now that Mullen's taken over and we go to bowl games every year, it seems like a much smaller time frame between when the season ends and then recruiting and then the spring game. So yeah, we got just a little bit of time left until we get to see the team take the field again. And obviously it's a positive thing to see them out there and talk about what we're going to try to see that improves this year in 2020.
Yeah. Good bit of questions. Some good questions that were sent our way from most of them sent on Twitter. So glad that listeners out there will feel included in sending their questions in, and a lot of, we'll dive heavy into the quarterback position of Kyle Trask, but the offense as a complete picture as well. Before we wrap up, we'll look into some recruiting with the big visit weekend coming up, Junior Day, March 7th, 6th, 7th, just coming up weekend, as well as looking back at a couple of commits the Gators got last week. Before we get there, remember you can find Gators Breakdown on news4jax.com/GatorsBreakdown. You'll find all the past Gators Breakdown episodes there, as well as News for Jax coverage of the Gators. And be sure to follow us on social media on Twitter and Facebook at Gators Breakdown. And as a reminder, come see me at a speaking engagement for the Fighting Gators Touchdown Club in Gainesville on April 23rd, right after the spring game on April 18th. So there'll be plenty to discuss there. The rest of the schedule this spring consists of strength and conditioning coach Nick Savage on March 26th. And head coach Dan Mullen on May 28th. So, Will, let's go ahead and get straight into the questions for this Q&A session here of looking at the offense for spring practice, our spring preview here on Gators Breakdown. So this is from sup_doc@PSL_Gator on Twitter. And what improvements do you want to see from Trask, Jones, and Richardson? And will the offensive line spring performance determine how the fall goes? We'll dive into the offensive line a little later as well, but we can include it in some of this talk here. And also from Felicia Earnshaw, what kind of role do you see Emory Jones playing this year as quarterback, assuming Kyle Trask is QB1? And that's still somewhat a debate out there if Kyle Trask needs to be QB1 from some of the Gator contingent out there, especially on Twitter and message boards and stuff. A fun debate I got into over the weekend on Facebook. So wasted a good bit of time on that. But so look, we'll get into it from a lot of research Will and I have done on this topic over the weekend, late last week over the weekend and stuff. So look, as well as Trask played last season, one instance he can get better is completing the deep ball. That's one of the arguments and debates got into over the weekend. Now, look, I don't think the deep pass is a staple of Mullen's offense. And while Florida did pass more last season mostly because of a lack of run game, it's not like the offense changed all that much, except for they passed the ball more within the same scheme of Dan Mullen's offense. So with that, there'll be still a good bit of screens, especially with the run game struggling like it did. A lot of those an extension of the run game. Also to get the ball into the wide receiver's hands as fast as possible. Let them go make a play. And we saw the athleticism of those wide receivers on display this past weekend at the NFL Combine, though. Get the ball in their hands. Let them go make a play. And look, I don't think so many screens were called to make up for Kyle Trask's arm strength. Is that an issue? Yes, but I think the reasons I listed were more of a reason, you know, but it still doesn't mean the issue isn't there. So, Will, you and I both wasted a lot of time with the help of SEC StatCat and their passing matrix chart there. So, huge thanks and kudos to those guys and the work they do there at SEC StatCat. So, if you guys haven't checked it out, go check it out there. So, now I found that of Trask, 237 completions last season. 70 of them were caught behind the line of scrimmage, good for 30% of his completions. Now, it may not be fair to compare to Joe Burrow from this past season, the historic season that he had, the stats he put up, but just as a comparison, you know, kind of give a ceiling look there. Of Burrow's 402 completions, only 55 were behind the line of scrimmage. That was good for only 14% of his completions. 30% of Trask's completions were behind the line of scrimmage, 14% for Burrow. So now one reason I'm kind of bringing up the arm strength thing issue that some out there, you know, that maybe reason Trask throws so many screens was because of his arm strength. And well, you know, if that's the case, one way to combat that and look at it from a different angle was what Felipe Franks did in 2018. Franks threw behind the line of scrimmage 35% of his 175 completions. So 5% more than Trask. Even with the bigger, stronger arm and an offense that could run to set up play action for some deep shots. More completions behind the line of scrimmage for Franks in 2018. So, you know, with that bit of info, it could be said that throws behind the line of scrimmage are more of a staple of this offense in two seasons under Dan Mullen, and you're just not going to see a lot of deep throws. But that doesn't mean it can't be better from Kyle Trask when those types of plays are called. So, Will, I know you detailed it in your latest article at Read and Reaction here, but on throws completed at 20-plus yards, only 6% of Trask's 237 completions came from there, and only 10% of his 354 attempts were 20-plus yards. So, Burrow completed 10% at 20-plus yards, while 14% of his attempts were 20-plus yards. So Franks in 2018 did attempt and complete more deep balls than Trask. With Franks, his 175 completions, 9% came at 20-plus yards, and 15% of his attempts were at the 20-plus yard mark. So now you can take that in a myriad of ways. Were more deep shots called for Franks? Did he just trust his arm more and wanted to throw deep more? Did the run game open up more shots down the field as compared to Trask? Those percentages may not seem like a lot, but over the course of a season can add up. You know, can hitting one, two, three more deep passes a game be a difference? And, you know, to look back, you know, Burrow completed 10% of his throws of 20-plus yards. Frank's right behind at 9%. Trask only hitting 6%. So, you know, that was good enough to win 11 games, Will. But this percentage, could be the difference in beating a Georgia and LSU, competing in the SEC. When you go to Atlanta, you're going to be playing better defenses there. So I think it's, you know, fair to ask there. You know, Trask played remarkable this past season, but if we're looking for improvement for this program to take the next step, for this offense to take the next step, for Kyle Trask to take the next step, then look no further than, you know, Kyle Trask hitting some more passes down the field.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that absolutely is going to have to improve. And one of the things that you saw when he was playing teams like Georgia or even some of the other games where he struggled, like against Missouri and against Auburn, I think one of the things that's sort of a hallmark of those teams was that they each had a very good linebacking core, and they were able to take those passes that started out behind the line of scrimmage and limit what the Gators were able to do. So in those three games against Georgia, Missouri, and Auburn, those were the three games where, other than the South Carolina game where there was a deluge during the game, but in those three games against Georgia, Missouri, and Auburn, when Trask completed passes behind the line of scrimmage, he completed 15 of 15 in those games, but he only averaged 4.5 yards an attempt. And then when you go and look at what he did for the overall season, he completed 96% of those throws for 8.1 yards per attempt. So in games where Trask was able to complete the ball behind the line of scrimmage and Florida was able to turn that into significant yardage, Trask put up very, very good numbers. Once the defense was able to take that away, then he struggled. And I think that's reflected in some of the other numbers as well. Mainly, and I highlighted this in my article today, but mainly the idea that he's far more effective, and you see this when you look at the tape too, he's far more effective at throwing routes that break in between the hashes. So the receiver starts on the outside, but then ends up coming back towards where Trask is throwing the ball. Then when he's trying to throw the ball outside the numbers. So if he's on the left hash, throwing to the right hash, he struggles a little bit. If he has to go downfield outside the numbers on the sideline, he struggles a little bit. And some of that is accurate. And actually it's interesting because when you look at the tape, he typically goes to the right receiver. It's just a question of does the ball get there or not. And that's a question of arm strength. And then it's also a question of what is the defense doing to dictate to Florida what's going on. So I was really surprised when I went back and looked at the Georgia game, how much two deep zone they played against Florida. But it starts to make sense because if your linebackers can cover those underneath routes, then you really force Trask to try to fit the ball into tight spaces going downfield to throw balls against the sideline. And if you can't run them out of the deep zone shells, then the quarterback's going to struggle. But that's also true for any sort of quarterback where the defense is allowed to play too deep. It's going to be hard to take advantage. It's going to be hard to throw deep because you can't run them out of it. They don't have to bring up that extra safety. You don't get an opportunity to take deep shots. So I think, you know, I think in Mullen's offense, and I think in Mullen's offense with Trask at the helm, they are probably going to take less deep shots than they would with Franks at quarterback. However, I think some of that comparison is a little bit unfair because Florida was able to run defenses into having to bring a safety up to stop the run, and then Franks was able to take shots over the top. And that just wasn't the case last year. I mean, Mullen really had to abandon the running game early on, and then when he did, he started to supplement it with different screen passes, and that's sort of where you see, I think, Trask throwing more screen passes than Franks did the year before.
Right, and you know this was not to try and talk people out of Kyle Trask not having any deficiencies on my end. I do think there are reasons for it in looking at it, and especially comparing that to Felipe Franks and how many screens Franks had to throw and rely on, you know, more percentage of his throws going behind the line of scrimmage as compared to Trask. It's an area for improvement, but for Trask, you know, getting some more help around him, I think will help that. Maybe as you mentioned, you know, the coverages deep are not set up for that, and there's a lot of. I remember the one play you picked out in the Georgia game. I think you hit Trevon Grimes on the sideline. You said it was perfect timing, a perfect throw, and it definitely had to be. Georgia had two guys in the area, like, so like you said, they kind of forced that throw, and it had to be a perfect throw from Kyle Trask. And that was one instance he did it outside on the numbers on the sideline, and Trevon Grimes goes up and gets it, makes a, you know, kind of a more of a high point catch, and you know, Georgia defenders couldn't get there in time. But that was still a coverage that was really meant to defend that type of pass, but was a great throw by Trask. You just need that on a little more consistent basis.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. Like, Trask averaged 8.3 yards per attempt last year. The NCAA average was 7.7. So he was an above-average quarterback throwing mm-hmm. the ball. I don't think that when I look at his stats, I don't necessarily think there's a whole lot of space for him to improve considerably. When you look at it, he completed 67% of his passes. Like I said, 8.3 yards per attempt. His interception rate was really low, and that's maybe the one thing that is a little bit alarming when you watch the tape, is that there are a lot of balls that sort of hang out there that the defense didn't get, and if they get in 2020, may have the ability to change a game and put Florida behind the chains considerably, or behind early if a ball gets taken the other direction. But beyond that, I mean, a QB rating of 156.1 through the air, Trask was really, really good last year. And I think that's one of the things that people are going to sort of have to accept, is that, you know, when you look at Burrow, and I looked at him and it looked at Burrow's 2018 and then 2019 in my article today, one of the things is that the last four games of 2018, there is a marked jump in not only his completion percentage, but also in his yards per completion. So he started throwing the ball down the field more at the end of 2018 and carried that over into 2019, as well as the accuracy. There isn't really an uptick in production for Trask towards the end of 2019. And so I don't necessarily think there's no indication that there's another gear. Whereas in 2018, you could have looked at what Burrow did towards the end of the year and said, hey, there's another gear for this guy to hit. Now, I don't think anybody, even myself, and I love Burrow, but I don't think anybody expected him to have quite the jump that he took from 2018 to 2019. But you know, this is also the thing we always talk about with recruiting. Can you win with just sort of borderline top 10 classes? Sure, there have been teams that have done that. But to pick that outlier and say that's what we expect, I think is probably not the best thing to do. You certainly don't want to rely on it. Trask is a very good quarterback. Is he going to transition from very good to elite? I don't necessarily see that in the stats, you know, when you look for the entire year or when you look towards the end of the year to see if there's a major uptick. So I think we can kind of expect a little bit of improvement as he gets some more experience under his belt. Obviously an easier schedule, so I suspect we'll see just better stats because he's not getting thrown right into the fire against Auburn and Kentucky and those guys. He's going to have some of those cupcake games early on to pad the stats. But at the end of the day, if people are expecting a Burrow-type leap, I think that's probably misguided. What we should probably expect is somebody who goes from just managing the game to somebody who might be able to win them a game or two when the offensive line gets shut down or when the running game gets shut down.
Yeah, I think the narrative I just kind of want to get rid of is that, you know, Trask was a proponent of a dink and dunk offense, and I don't, you know, it was not a dink and dunk offense to me when I look at it here. So if you're going to call it a dink and dunk offense with Trask in there, then you would have had to do it when Franks was in there too.
It's an inside the numbers offense, right? There's not a whole lot that goes to the sideline, and I do think that has something to do with arm strength. There's no shame in saying, hey, the guy throws to the right guy, and sometimes is limited in terms of where he can make the throw. I'll take that all the time. Somebody who completes 67% of his passes. The place where Trask struggled last year and didn't contribute as much value as Felipe Franks did the year before is really the running game. It's 63 attempts for 8 yards, and you know Franks had like 320 yards the year before, and all those fourth downs against South Carolina where Franks was able to lead the comeback, all the running that he did against Michigan. The only game that we really saw Trask run the ball even at all was against Virginia, and other than that, it was pretty limited all year long. Now, he did have the knee injury against Auburn, but still, a Dan Mullen offense, you expect to see more than 63 attempts for 8 yards, even when you factor in sacks, because you got to factor in sacks for Felipe Franks, too, and like I said, the year before, he ran for over 300 yards.
Yeah, I got some stuff on the run game coming up as well, because it's definitely a place I think Kyle Trask showed late in the season, as you kind of mentioned, the Virginia game, but the FSU game a little bit as well. The ability to run the ball a little bit. So to kind of further the extension on what I want to see from Kyle Trask, and you know, kind of looking at some more stats there in relation to another thing about the numbers, and then just this whatever reason the throws just popped in my head. Those back shoulder throws to Van Jefferson against in the LSU game, you know, was something we haven't really seen from a Florida quarterback in quite some time there. So. It's there sometimes, as we said, more consistent is what we want to see there. So, you know, no comparing to Burrow probably isn't fair, but, you know, at least gives a ceiling of how good it can be. And Will, you know, surprisingly, 57% of Burrow's completions come from 0 to 10 yard throws. And then the receiver's taking off and doing a whole lot there, especially that slant that they just kept hitting over and over again. A staple of that offense was something that comes to mind. But, you know, 57% of Burrow's completions come from 0 to 10 yards and 18% from 11 to 20 yards. Trask had 43% of his completions from 0 to 10 yards and 18 to 11 to 20 yards. So Trask really liked that intermediate range throws there. Another surprising stat I found was Trask actually had a higher average depth of target than Tua Tagovailoa. 8.84 yards for Trask and 8.75 for Tua. But here's the thing, Will. That stat may not tell the whole story because notable QBs in order that received a good bit of playing time that were higher than, say, Trask and Tua. Guarantano, 11.2 yards average depth of target. Matt Corral, 10.47. Jake Fromm, 10.44. Burrow, 9.62. Kellen Mond at 9.35. Bo Nix at 9.29. Before you even get to Trask and Tua. So, you know, while an average depth of target would be nice if it increased, there are many quarterbacks that ranked ahead of Trask and Tua that didn't necessarily have an overall season like those guys had. So, you know, Burrow in that category and nowhere near playing Burrow, Tua, Trask were all around the same area, and the other quarterbacks ahead of them were nowhere near playing at the level of those three quarterbacks there. So, you know, what that kind of tells me with Burrow, Trask, and Tua had some wide receivers they could rely on to catch a pass and make something happen after the catch and get the ball to the wide receiver. So kind of to further extend this, you know, I couldn't go as deep as I did on the deep ball and behind the line of scrimmage passes on this part, but another comparison I wanted to look at is yards per attempt for the best Mullen quarterbacks compared to Trask. Tebow in 2008, 9.2 yards per attempt. Dak Prescott in 2014, 8.7 yards per attempt. Prescott in 2015, 8 yards per attempt. And Trask last season, 8.3 yards per attempt. So that would have ranked third for Mullen quarterbacks if you're looking at yards per attempt in those great seasons of Tebow and Prescott. Difference there, Will, he couldn't supplement that with a run game from his own.
Sure. Well, or from the running backs last
or the running backs.
Yeah. But I mean, so I think there's a lot to unpack there. But the first thing I would say is that the target stats that you cited there, where you're saying how far downfield he targeted, a lot of that is dictated by score, right? If you're down by 25 points and you're Ole Miss, you're going to be chucking it down the field. Trask never had to do that this year. I mean, Florida was behind against Kentucky, and I'm pretty sure if you looked at his average target against Kentucky, it was probably much further down the field than later in the year in games where Florida was ahead. And Florida, for the most part, won every game comfortably except for the game against LSU and the game against Georgia. If you consider the Virginia game a comfortable win, I do. They were up by two touchdowns with less than a minute to go.
Yeah, and Missouri maybe there too.
So. I mean, maybe, but it was still, 20-3? So you look at it and say Florida did not trail much at all, basically, after Trask came in. And so it's not really all that surprising that he's not going down the field all that much, because you're not going to take giant risks when you're up by, you know, two touchdowns against Auburn. Like, and it did kind of feel like the offense kind of just said, all right, we got this one. We've gotten ahead. We hit Swain on the quick slant across the middle, you know, got a couple of turnovers and are able to convert that into a lead. And we're just going to sort of sit on it for a little bit. And that is sort of what that game felt like. And I think that's kind of what the season felt like. So Florida's offense was very, very good in 2019. I think they were 22nd in yards per attempt overall, but they weren't elite. They weren't a top 10 offense. I think that's kind of what we saw, is they struggled from time to time, especially against better teams. And that's reflected, I think, in how often they went down the field. You know, you compare them to a guy like Tua. Tua had some special weapons there.
Yeah.
three receivers that they had there. What was it, Ruggs, who ran a 4.23 or something in the 40 this weekend at the combine? So, you know, I can understand completely why you just throw a little slant to him and let him run. So,
and that was just one metric, of course. I mean, we saw Tua, you know, chug it down the field plenty of times.
Sure. But I mean, again, I think one of the things that you noticed in Mullen's first go round in Gainesville is how much they wanted to utilize the running backs, you know, and how much they wanted to go side to side. And side to side opens things up to go downfield. And a lot of those little bubble screens are designed to free up someone. So, you know, games where Grimes was able to break one for a big touchdown because they got the ball to the outside. I mean, that's really what Mullen wants to do. So,
and the first touchdown of the season, Will. Kadarius Toney takes one, you know, against Miami.
Yeah, I mean, so it's just a different offensive scheme than what Joe Brady's doing at LSU. Mm-hmm. And so comparing those guys side by side, yes, I mean, obviously you want to be able to replicate every one of Burrow's stats from 2019, but it's a different offense. And to your point, it's an offense that relies on a quarterback who can throw the ball downfield when he needs to, but not necessarily rely on that as the only way to move the ball downfield.
All right, well, so yeah, in summary there, as far as, you know, Trask arm strength, all that stuff goes, yeah. Is there an issue? Yes. Does it need to be improved? Can it be improved? I think is the question. Can he do that? How does he do that? You know, how much can he improve that? And in turn, how much does that really help the offense? Schedule gets easier, as you said, but, you know, there will be a time this season where the defenses will test what we've talked about here and discussed here. And make Kyle Trask make some of those big-time throws time and time again. So we kind of teased it, Will, and Trask and his legs, and where, you know, he can improve there as well, and with some help from the offensive line. But, you know, from the UT Martin, because he got some playing time in that game, even though Felipe Franks did start that game, Trask played in that game as well. But from the UT Martin game through the Missouri game, 10 games there, Trask had only 23 design run attempts. So, you know, basically two design carries a game for 76 yards, good for 3.3 yards a rush, on an average of 5.5 yards to gain. Only 30% of those were converted to a first down. Better late in the season, as I said. The last two games of the season, FSU and Virginia, in those two games, he had 8 design runs for 35 yards, averaging 4.3 yards per run on an average of 3.9 yards to gain. So, he averaged more than the average yard to gain in those design run situations. So half of those went for a first down. He converted that. So, hopefully we saw better use of Trask late in the season with his legs that converts and transfers over to this year. As a comparison, Will, Franks in 2018 ran for 3.68 yards per carry on design runs. So Trask in 2019 as a whole ran for 3.58. So just, a tenth of a yard less for there for Trask compared to Franks. Emory ran for 6.1 yards per carry on design runs during the season. So Trask not really that far from Franks, as far as average goes. StatCat didn't have the Michigan game when looking at this for Felipe Franks. But when you're looking at averages, it's not going to change all that much looking at the season as a whole. So not far off from what some numbers go from what Franks did in 2018. Hopefully the last two games are more of a look at how he was using the run game in more short yardage situations, more conducive situations for success. And also, Will, you brought up too, I just don't know how much it can be gauged, and if we'll ever know how hurt he was after that Auburn game and how much that limited. Look, don't get me wrong. Kyle Trask isn't going to be Dak Prescott or Tim Tebow out there running. But, can he go pick up 2 or 3 yards when needed? And, later in the season, he showed he might have an ability to do so.
Yeah, I mean, so anybody who's ever sprained a knee ligament knows that it's a little bit difficult to go out there 1 week later and put your body on the line and go out there and run. Certainly Trask went out there and did the best that he could and valiantly went out there and didn't miss any other time except for when Mullen pulled him out to put Emory Jones in there. But everybody gets banged up in the SEC, and it's pretty clear that Trask got banged up. And I think having a month off before Virginia maybe gives us that Virginia game, maybe gives us an idea of what we're going to see. That's a little bit different than what we saw throughout the year this year. But again, he's not necessarily the most mobile guy. And I suspect that's what we'll see in 2020 as well. The big thing is that the 8 yards that he's got rushing is in stark contrast to what you just cited there in terms of his yards per attempt as a, as designed runs. And so one of the things that he's going to need to improve on is just not taking the number of sacks that he took, especially mm-hmm. early on, that contributes to all of these rushing statistics that you look at. But the reality is that some of those sacks, again, when I went back and looked at the Georgia tape, there were 2 drives specifically where sacks just absolutely destroyed the drive. Florida couldn't get the Georgia offense off the field, and so the offense bogged down because he was taking sacks in those situations. So, I like looking at the overall yardage that the quarterback runs for, because I do think that takes into account his decision-making ability, and that's one of the things that I think is that we talked a little bit about arm strength. I'm not sure what you necessarily do about that, mm-hmm. but I think from decision-making and making sure that you get the ball out and making sure that you throw the ball away when you have the opportunity to throw it away, that you don't take a back-breaking sack. Those are the things that I think you can improve on in the offseason, the things that you can improve on as you watch tape, get experience. And so if we see Trask with 200 or 250 yards rushing in 2020, I think that's really an indication he's taken a step forward and that he's running Mullen's offense in a way that is as efficient as it's going to be with him at the position.
All right. So to kind of move on here keep going with the question here is the question we received about this quarterback position and what we can expect from all these quarterbacks. With Emory Jones, to me, it's kind of hard to pinpoint his role just because we still don't see a whole lot, Will. Versus Tennessee Martin, Tennessee, Towson, Auburn, and LSU, he had 28 pass attempts, 21 of those versus Tennessee, Towson, and Auburn. So then none versus South Carolina and Georgia, where he also really only had 2 rushing attempts in those close games as well. 3 pass attempts versus Vandy in a blowout, 1 versus Missouri, 6 pass attempts in the blowout versus Florida State, and then none again in the bowl game where he ran the ball four times. And you were looking at that bowl game as maybe an opportunity while you have some bowl prep to maybe insert Emory Jones for some more passing, and we didn't see it. So you know, we're definitely going to see it in the spring because that's the nature of the beast of spring practice. But you know, I want to see him get to a point where the coaches trust him more to throw in games. He's coming into his third season, and if he's on the field, it's time to see confidence in him. But you know, he's got to be able to check to the right play, get the offensive line signals, call out coverages, you know, basically understand what to do within the offense. You know, the best we saw of Emory Jones is when he takes over for Trask in the second quarter of that Auburn game. He led a drive to a field goal and a 17-13 lead that the Gators would take in the halftime there and eventually go on to win that game. And it would have been easy to just come in and be conservative with Jones from the coaching staff. But, you know, Florida wasn't going to win the game that way. We still had no idea if Trask was going to come back. And that drive, Jones goes 3-for-4 passing, setting up Florida for a field goal in a close game. So, you know, I don't know if the question surrounding Trask injuries calls Mullen to be more aggressive with Emory in that situation, you know, more than he showed the rest of the season or what it was. But you know, it was such a small sample size to make a broad determination on what type of quarterback we'd be getting full time with Emory. You know, so as far as the answer to what role Emory plays, you know, based on what we see this spring, I really think it just comes down to overall progression from him.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be careful attributing Trask being the starter last year to Emory Jones not necessarily being able to take a step forward in the offense. I think the guys were probably pretty even. Trask probably had some advantages in the passing game and executing the offense. But you know, you saw it early on, like you mentioned, the Auburn game where he was key to Florida winning that game because he was able to drive them down when Trask was out. But even if you think about the LSU game, there was a significant package for Emory Jones. That game, they brought him in down in the red zone where he threw sort of that fourth down touchdown to the receivers who were out there. They brought him in late in, I think it was late in the third quarter, and gave him a full drive when Florida was in their own territory, much to the chagrin of a bunch of fans who decided to second guess it after it occurred. But you know, I think that LSU game was also sort of where you started to see differentiation between Emory Jones and Trask, right? I mean, they went in there with the plan to have both those guys play. They saw Trask play so well in that game against LSU, and he sort of took hold of the job and didn't give it up the rest of the year. I don't think that's necessarily a poor reflection on Emory Jones. I think it's a reflection on Trask and what he was able to do. So, you know, Jones is going to have the opportunity to do it again in the spring and in all the practices and sort of wrestle that back from Trask. And I do think there's going to be not necessarily an open competition, but I think there's going to be a competition for snaps. And that's maybe the thing that I'd like to see from Emory Jones is just that the total number of snaps that he takes goes up because he's been able to be more competitive and been able to wrestle some of those snaps away from Kyle Trask. And if he's able to do that, then, you know, we've mentioned a lot about Trask's inability to run the ball last year. Well, that's not a problem with Emory Jones. And if you bring the passing threat to that, to where he can take a few deep shots out of those formations. Again, this sort of goes back to the everybody we talked about it coming into last year. I think the same thing holds true for 2020, sort of the ideal model being the Tebow leak tandem in 2006 and the way that they were able to hand back and forth and sort of run on and off the field. The more snaps Emory Jones is able to wrestle from Trask, the more it's going to look like that. I don't think there's, barring injury, I don't think Emory Jones is going to be the full-time starter, but I think he can start to wrestle some of those snaps away from Trask and contribute more in that way.
Well, I think I agree with what you're saying there. Make yourself valuable enough to where they have to play you. And that's, I think, a good way of putting it when Emory Jones gets some playing time there. So as far as Anthony Richardson goes, you know, we don't really know a whole lot. We'll see a lot of basics from Anthony Richardson this spring to get his feet wet. Use this spring to get him adjusted to throwing in the college game. I think the running aspect of his game will just come natural. The hardest part's, you know, coming into college and learning to read more complex defenses while passing the ball. Richardson made a jump in how accurate he was from his junior to senior season. To see him hold steady with that part of his game would be nice. So, you know, now this made me think of how we may see him used in the regular season if we're going to move forward just a bit. And you know, he's going to get four games. I don't think they'll burn his red shirt at all. I only expect to see him in four games coming up this season. So you'll definitely get him some playing time versus Eastern Washington, South Alabama, New Mexico State. And we'll kind of, you know, there's three cupcakes right there. Does he play in all three of those games? But you know, how do you use that fourth game if those three games are the ones he plays in to get him some experience? And you go back, Will, and we saw Mullen give Emory a bit of action his freshman season versus in a big game like Georgia. You know, do we see some kind of package in that game to surprise the Bulldogs? You know, is there a time where Mullen wants to save hits on Emory as a running threat, you know, from the quarterback position and put Richardson in instead? Emory's your backup quarterback. You still want to protect him when you can, but I'm also a believer in not coaching scared. You know, injuries are part of the game. If that happens, it happens. But is there a point in the season where Mullen's like, okay, you know, let's save Emory from getting hit so much. We have a big-bodied quarterback here that can go convert those, you know, 2 yards that we need for a first down. So, but it all starts at some point, you know, in the spring where you have to trust him first, and that all starts this spring.
Yeah, I mean, I think Florida fans should probably hope that they don't see a whole lot of Anthony Richardson, not because we don't want to see Richardson or because we don't think he's all that great, but I think over the last couple of years, Mullen has proven that when he doesn't feel like his guys who need to get reps have gotten them, he will leave them in the game. So Franks played an awful lot in 2018, you know, even in games that were well in hand because Mullen felt like he needed to get him reps. I think the same can be said last year for Kyle Trask, where Trask would still be in the game late, and you'd be surprised he would still be in the game late. And there was quite a bit of consternation among the fan base that we weren't getting to see Emory Jones. And I think a lot of the reason that he had him in there was he wanted to make sure that he got him reps, because this is a guy who hasn't had a whole lot of reps. And I think the same thing can be said for Emory Jones coming into 2020. And so I suspect that what's probably going to happen is Trask is going to start. Jones is going to get a lot of those reps when the game is well in hand. And I don't know how many of those reps are going to be there for Anthony Richardson, to be honest with you. I think if he is getting reps, that's indicative that he's caught up to those two guys, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, right? I guess it depends on how well Trask and Jones are playing. If Anthony Richardson is getting out there and getting reps and those guys are playing great, then it's a good sign. If Anthony Richardson is getting a bunch of playing time and those guys aren't playing real well, then it's obviously a bad sign. So my desire would be, you get him in a couple of those cupcake games, let him get his feet wet because you've got the four-game rule with the red shirt. But really that you get him in where he can get a quarter and you can chuck the ball around and get used to being in there, as opposed to you know, just putting him in there and letting him run the ball, which is kind of what they did with Emory Jones that first year, other than the Georgia game. Like you mentioned, they had a package. But you know, that was still when Felipe Franks was really struggling in that game against Georgia and then the game against Missouri a week later. So Trask hasn't shown that level of struggle yet. And if we don't see that, I don't know that we're necessarily going to see a special package for Richardson.
All right, let's move on to some more questions as we move on from the quarterback position there. So I was kidding around with Will. I knew the quarterback the quarterback talk would take around 30 minutes. Well, 37 minutes. So quarterback, of course, when you talk about these Gators. So let's move on to GatorBoss904, who sends in the question, who is the third wide receiver behind Grimes and Tony? And then from Bull Gators, at Riverside, LAX39, who steps up for the senior wide receivers that left? Grimes and Coke should show out this year, but who's the next 3 to 4 options there? So go back to this first one from GatorBoss904, who's the third wide receiver behind Grimes and Tony. Going into spring, I guess you can label, and we'll keep Kyle Pitts out of this, we'll keep him solely for tight end for the sake of this conversation here. Grimes and Tony is who GatorBoss904 lists 1 and 2. That's probably okay going into spring, but if I had to pick a third, but I'd actually move to number two, I think this is the spring Jacob Copeland puts it all together. I think this is the time we see him become the wide receiver that's not held back, and not necessarily so much because of his own doing, but Florida was just so deep at wide receiver. And I mean, I know he's supposed to be this big-time superstar, elite guy, but is he really going to go out there and play over Van Jefferson, Freddie Swain, Josh Hammond, Tyree Cleveland, guys who have so much experience and block well and really, you know, played so well within this offense? You know, I don't look at it too much as a detriment of the performance Jacob Copeland put together from himself. I just think there was a lot of other options out there that kept him from being on the field so much. So you guys were reliable playmakers out there that you weren't not going to put the ball in their hands. So I think this is the spring, Will, where I see it would be kind of hard to label Copeland as a breakout player, but you know, maybe for lack of a better term, a guy that really just puts it all together and really just kind of maybe is really up there with Grimes as, you know, a one big time 1-2 punch.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, I mean, obviously the three guys who have experience are Cope, yeah. Tony, and Grimes, and then Pitts. So when you look at the offense last year, it was mostly three wide receivers. They would split out Pitts and they would split out P. Ryan. So if you think about the way the offense is set up, they're set up right now to have those three wide receivers. So Grimes, Tony, and Copeland. And then the question I have is, okay, you're still going to split out Pitts, but who's that guy who sort of replaces the P. Ryan role getting split out there? Is it going to be Damian Pierce? Is it going to be Malik Davis? Is it going to be Keon Zipper? Is it going to be Rick Wells? Is it going to be somebody who we don't know yet from either the 19 or the 20 class? Some of those taller guys we talked about the last couple of weeks.
We've seen Copeland maybe as a role in the backfield. So maybe him and some capacity as well.
Sure. Or do you do something crazy and put Emory Jones out there as one of the guys that you split out wide? So I don't know that we're going to see any of that in the spring game, obviously. And the way they've done the spring game in the past is they've split the units relatively evenly. So we're going to see a lot of those guys out there. There's just not a whole lot of tape, at least not at the college level, of any of these guys necessarily going out there. So and playing. So again, guys like, you know, Iverson Clement and Naquan Wright, those are guys who might have an opportunity to split out and catch a few balls as well. So I guess the question of the top three receivers, I think, is pretty obvious in terms of who's been out there and who has the most experience. The question I have is, are they going to split out Pitts more often? Are they going to make him less of a tight end? Do you slide Zipper into tight end so that you can have Pitts go out and essentially be a wide receiver rather than have him line up and block and be a tight end? They're going to have to make some personnel adjustments because, you know, it's been 4 years of having those guys out there at wide receiver and all the different skills that they have. I think the guys they have now have different skill sets. I don't know if they're better or worse. I just think they're different. Now, one thing that you mentioned was Copeland not necessarily getting the ball because it had to go to all those other guys. I think we saw that in the combine where Van Jefferson just impressed everyone out there in terms of his ability to run routes, his ability to get separation. But it wasn't as though Florida was necessarily relying on Van Jefferson. I mean, he caught 49 balls last year, which was second on the team, but it's not as though he was catching 80 and the next closest guy was catching 40. So even though he went out there and impressed and was impressing during camp 2 years ago as well, and was clearly the best wide receiver, just the way Mullen's offense works is you throw to the guy who's open and where the coverage dictates. And I think that's really what you're going to look for, is the guy who does the right thing and runs the right route and runs the route the right way is the guy who's going to step in to that role. Is that going to be somebody like, you know, Jamarcus Weston? Is it going to be somebody like Trent Whittemore? Is it going to be somebody like Xavier Henderson? That's something that's difficult to predict, but they may end up having to do some personnel stuff that's a little bit different than they've done in the past couple of years, just to take advantage of the skill guys who've been in the program for a little while.
And Will, you mentioned guys like, you know, Weston, Marks, Whittemore. This spring's important for them though, because, you know, Florida has some big time freshmen coming in the fall. So this is, you know, Frazier's and Henderson coming in the fall. You know, this spring really is important for, you know, those guys who got redshirted, and Rick Wells, who hasn't really proven a whole lot either. You know, this spring's important for those guys to go ahead and get, you know, the reps and make an impression on these coaches before these true freshmen that are highly touted come in and start, you know, fighting for reps come the fall. So guys from Marks, Weston, and Whittemore, we've seen some athleticism from those guys in videos and going back to last spring as well. But this spring's huge for those guys, as, you know, they, with so much leaving the wide receiver position from Florida, they're going to get a chance to break through this spring.
Yeah, well, I actually think that's really one of the places where you can learn something from the spring game. I think the spring game in many cases can be difficult to learn something just because of the way they set things up. But I remember watching last year, you know, I went down with my son, and the guy who jumped off the field was Kyle Pitts. Yep. And we had seen him play the year before, and he'd run a few slants, and they'd had him outside, but he wasn't a huge focal point of the offense. But after the spring game, you knew that was a guy they were going to get the ball to, that he was just different in terms of his ability to be out there. So I'm really interested to see, do we see the same thing with Jamarcus Weston? Do we see the same thing with Deontay Marks? Do we see the same thing with Trent Whittemore? Is there a guy who athletically jumps off the page? And if he does, then, hey, that's the guy they're probably going to put out there and have him start to fill that role. But the other thing is that, you know, those are those are guys who can fill gaps on special teams as well. And that's something that, you won't see during the spring game, but just having the depth on those guys filling roles on special teams. And one of the things last year is Swain was on special teams. Cleveland was on special teams. I'm not sure you're going to be able to do that this year.
Van Jefferson too.
Yeah, I'm not sure you're going to be able to do that just because you won't have the depth. So some of these new guys who are coming in are going to have to fill up that depth on punt coverage teams, kickoff coverage teams, things like that.
All right, move on to the tight end position here. And a question from NC Gator King at Lance KI and a bunch of numbers. So here we go. One question that isn't really asked is, how does Zipper's development look and how will Mullen use him? While Pitts can stretch outside, Zip could be an effective blocker and receiver from inside. Does that give away to more two tight end sets? So I really do think that gives away to some, more two tight end sets. And we already know what Pitts can do, and those guys on the field at the same time can really open up the middle for an athlete like Zipper, as long as he proves to be a capable blocker. I don't think you'll see both of them together on each side of the formation and on the end of the line all that much. I think Pitts spends a majority of his time split out wide. But maybe where Pitts shift out or lines up outside and Zipper is on the end line creating a mismatch versus a linebacker, I think you might see that combination a bit. But that won't work well if he's not a capable blocker, though, and the play call becomes predictable. You can't just if Zipper is out there, oh, it's going to be a pass play because we know he can't block. So go back, Mullen's days as offensive coordinator at Florida, and Aaron Hernandez is out there. That's how I see Keon Zipper being used, and maybe we get the ultimate comeback of the shovel pass.
Zipper's a lot shorter than Pitts, so he's 6'2", yeah. 232. So he's a little bit different player, I think. But sometimes being shorter gives you a little bit more leverage when you're out there blocking. Yes, your tight end is going to have to block, especially with the way the offensive line struggled last year. I'm sure that's going to be an area of emphasis. And really being able to bring in a guy to block, and even if he is just the blocking tight end, having a blocking tight end along with Kyle Pitts in two tight end sets still should leave that blocking tight end open quite a bit if you happen to send both of them out in route. So yes, the development of Zipper I think will be important, but I think more than anything, understanding who that fifth guy is going to be. That was one of the things that when you looked at what Mullen did in the game against Auburn to free up P. Ryan on the run, part of that, he had sort of a diamond formation where he put a bunch of receivers out to the left-hand side. And basically, even though P. Ryan got hit in the hole, he only had to break that one tackle. He was able to take it to the house. There were other times where he split P. Ryan out. I mean, the Michigan Bowl game 2 years ago, where it was sort of that four wide receiver formation, but one of them was P. Ryan, and that meant P. Ryan was either on a linebacker or a safety. He sort of swept in behind the wide receivers who were blocking and then was able to make some big plays that way. And so who's that guy going to be? And can Zipper be that guy? Can he be a guy who allows Florida to get the matchups that they want because they don't have to take him off the field when they want to split him out wide? Sort of the same thing with Pitts. Like, Pitts needs likely to improve on his blocking a little bit, which gives him more flexibility there. And then Zipper, you hope that he's a pretty good blocker, and then what can he do when you split him out wide? But if Zipper shows that he can be split out wide, I think you're going to see an awful lot of two tight end sets, and I think you're going to see a lot of two tight end sets that look more like five wide sets, just because that'll allow Florida to take advantage of the defense and some of the limitations that the defenses have in terms of being able to take on those two guys.
All right, and we've mentioned this group a couple of times in regards to Kyle Trask and the run game just in general. As well, and this is the offensive line. So thanks to Oliver Teston, Ricky Spitznogel, and Bobby Glenn at Rowdy Lizard for sending in their offensive line questions, kind of detailing, where do we see the run game going? Will it be more like the first season under Dan Mullen? Will it be more like last season when it didn't really live up to what we thought? It just never really came about. It never looked like the first season for Dan Mullen there, and how much emphasis will be on run blocking this spring. And so going to here, so basically also asking us, how do we see this group shaking out? So first of all, I think more experience always helps and should at least provide a baseline boost for the offensive line group, Will, but too many times last year where they just looked lost. They'd get to a second level, not know what to do, where to go, who to block, if they got pushed that far. So I do believe just general experience can really help, but mostly the same group from 2017 to 2018 made a jump, even in a new offense, because there was experience in just playing the game of football and playing together as a group. And it was a bit of a slow start that season, but by season's end, the Florida offensive line was playing really well in the pass game, protecting Felipe Franks and opening up holes for Scarlett, Pirine, and Franks. So because of experience, I see Stone Forsythe sticking at left tackle, but he's got to improve some technique along the way this spring. So left tackle, I think, is pretty much a shoe-in there. I think the bigger question becomes, where does Richard Garage line up? The line is much better. It showed last year, much better with him on it, but most of his experience was at left guard. So I do think that's, I do think wherever he lines up, it really benefits Florida. But do they maybe switch him out at tackle at one point, maybe that right tackle spot as well? Brett Hagee's move to center doesn't really bother me. If that's what happens, as he has so much experience in this offense and playing the game of football, as now his third year in this offense, I don't know why he seemed to drop off a little bit last year. Like I said, the group as a whole didn't live up to an expectation. But if there was one guy I thought this offensive line could count on last season to be a rock there and a rock this year, it would have and is going to be him. But he struggled along with the rest of them. So we'll see how much of a change he has to make when he does. The thought is he's going to be playing center this coming up year. Ethan White showed up in the starting lineup late last season, played really well for a true freshman there at right guard. He's a shoe-in pretty much there and really looking at, from him, how much he can improve with another year of strength and conditioning along with more experience as he continues his progression, since he got a lot of his playing time late in the season last year. So now the right tackle, I know a sore spot for many. I don't know what happens there. Does Gene DeLance improve so much from last season that he can keep his spot there? And, going against everything, Will, I just said about experience, does redshirt freshman Michael Tarquin, the coaches were high on him late last season, or one of the true freshmen, Isaiah Walker or Joshua Braun, cracked the rotation. Experience is nice and all, but sometimes talent trumps all those, and those guys may see their way onto the playing field to help out there. So that's asking a lot of the early enrollees, Walker and Braun, to come out there and force playing time. But they came to Florida as highly rated prospects, ready to play. So to me, this spring is about getting past the fundamentals so much, because you do have a lot of experience coming back with a group of four guys, five guys there, as compared to last year. Build on the experience of last season and work on the things that plagued this group last season.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things you see is from the transition recruiting year for Dan Mullen, Richard Garage was the most talented offensive lineman in that class. Did not make a huge impact in the 2018 season, but then in the 2019 season played significant minutes. So in that second year in the system, was able to come in and contribute. You look at a guy like Noah Banks, who also came in that season. He was going to be a contributor last year, but then had injuries. And I think that was a big problem for Florida. I think they were really relying on Banks, and having him be injured was a real problem. You had Blake, who struggled at right guard a little bit and then transferred halfway through the year. And then you got Griffin McDowell, who was a center transfer, a center recruit who had been committed to Mississippi State originally and then decided to come to Florida. So there wasn't necessarily a whole lot of numbers. There weren't a whole lot of high talent level guys who could be relied on from that 2018 class. And then last year, look at Ethan White. We started to see him make some contribution towards the end of the year. And then you mentioned guys like Tarquin, guys like Herod, guys like Riley Simons even, and Kingsley Gwakwin. Those are guys who I think you're going to be able to see push some of the guys like Gene DeLance, Stone Forsythe, and even Brett Hagee in some respects as well. Like, push those guys to be better, because in their second year, understanding the system is really going to help. So one of the things I like doing is, so Football Outsiders has a bunch of different offensive line stats, but one stat that I really like is opportunity rate. And the reason I like that is, in the running game, it's really trying to define the percentage of carries in which the line does its job. And Florida ranked 125th out of 128 teams last year in terms of doing its job as the offensive line. And And when you're not doing your job, typically what happens is you get replaced. But last year, they didn't really have the bodies. They didn't have guys with experience to replace them. I think this year they're going to have that, not only with the guys that they've brought in the 2020 class, but guys that they brought in the 2019 class as well. And John Hevesy has a really good track record of seeing improvement year to year. It's one of the reasons why I think we should be encouraged at the running game being successful in that game against Virginia, because with a little bit of time, getting the line situated with Garage and White being the guys who were really in there in that particular game extensively, Florida's offensive line played much, much better in that game than they had at any point during the year. Was it perfect? No, absolutely not. But it was better than it had been throughout the year against a pretty decent Virginia team. I mean, Virginia isn't a top 10 team by any means, but still a pretty decent team, and they were able to run the ball way better than they were during the season. And if you look at Florida under McElwain from 2015 to 2017, averaged 79th in opportunity rate. Hevesy comes in 2018 in Mullen's first year. All of a sudden, Florida jumps to 17th. They have to replace that entire offensive line. They fall down to 125th. I guarantee you John Hevesy is not going to see that as acceptable, and I suspect there's going to be a pretty significant uptick in terms of the offensive line's ability to do the job that they're tasked to do, and I think that's one of the things that Gator fans should track going through the 2020 season is opportunity rate from Football Outsiders.
Yeah, so the guys I mentioned, I think, are the group that you'll see most of this spring, but the guys Will ended up mentioning in a lot of the depth, those are the guys you want to hear a lot from, the guys we want to see a lot of, because as Will said, they're going to either push those starting five there, you know, like I said, right tackle, I know, you know, just reading the YouTube comments here, Jeannie Lance is, you know, kind of getting bashed a whole lot. It was the offensive line as a whole wasn't very good last year, but that right side really struggled. Ethan White, as I said, come in late last year, but you know, a lot of those guys Will mentioned there, you know, those are guys we want to see a good bit, a whole lot of this spring, and pushing for jobs and creating depth there along this Florida offensive line. So that'll do it for this offense in our Q&A session here next week. Nick De La Torre from Gator Country will join me as we answer questions about the defense there. So looking forward to that as we all wrap up our spring preview the week before spring practice as we look at the defense there. So before we go, let's take a quick look at some recruiting news, recruiting update here on Gators Breakdown. Big week in recruiting, last kind of couple weeks here for the Gators. Two commits last week and Junior Day coming up this coming up weekend. So Will, Gators get two commitments last week. The newest commit, tight end Gage Wilcox. We kind of previewed this last week. We felt good really about this one. 6'4", 228 pounds. He was the 248th ranked player on the 24/7 Sports Composite, the 11th ranked tight end in the country. 24/7 had him ranked as 278th ranked player. Rivals up at 232. ESPN valued him at 241. Willis stats from 2019, 9 games, 20 catches, 249 yards, 7 touchdowns. 20 catches, 7 touchdowns. Kind of, you know, without going back and watching and looking at a lot of snaps, that, you know, probably a red zone threat there in the end zone. Big bodied, tight end, receiver, hybrid, great body control, likes to go up and get the ball. Gators get a good one here, Will.
Yeah, well, for somebody who's a little bit challenged in this area, his hair is just fantastic. So I'm sure you can relate, buddy.
He's got me beat there.
But no, I mean, I think obviously bringing in Brewster has been pretty significant. I mean, we've seen a lot of energy from not only just the tight end position, but recruiting at Florida overall, and certainly Wilcox is one of those guys. I saw somebody on Twitter, I wish I could give him credit, but I can't remember who did it, but they said he needs to wear number 12, give Richardson number 15, and then it can be AR-15 to 12 gauge who when they're out there playing. So I'm here for it, man. If 2 years from now, that's what we're hearing, I'm all for it. But now, like you mentioned, 6'4", 228, you know, sort of, you mentioned Hernandez earlier. I think if you go back and look at Hernandez's stats, or at least his profile, I bet you that they're relatively similar. Now, Aaron Hernandez is a special player when it comes to his ability to do things on the field. Same thing with Kyle Pitts. I think it's dangerous to start comparing guys to those guys, but at the same time, 7 touchdowns is 7 touchdowns. And one of the areas where Florida has struggled is short yardage. One of the areas where Florida has struggled is in the red zone, not just this year, but in 2018 as well under Mullen. It was really a Felipe Franks run or or, you know, miss an open guy in the end zone. It was sort of that 2018 offense. And having a guy who can be a threat in the red zone is a big deal. They run that play where the tight end sort of fakes to block and then goes across the formation. And we haven't seen it be successful very often. And hopefully somebody like Wilcox is somebody who can open that up as well.
All right, and then also shout out to Larry Scott there too, tight end coach before Tim Brewster. Put in a lot of legwork, a lot of work in making a relationship with Will Cox before he left to become head coach at Howard. So big credit goes to Larry Scott too there for opening that door for the Gators and Tim Brewster coming in and just locking it and getting that commitment there from Will Cox. Also last week, Will, the Gators get a big commitment, Justin Boone out of Sumter, South Carolina. And when I say big, I mean big. Three-star, strong side defensive end that will be rising. If you go out there, Steve Wiltfong from 24/7, their national recruiting analyst, is really big on Boone here. But 6'5", 250 pounds, 371st ranked player on the 24/7 sports composite, 26th ranked strong side defensive end in the country, second ranked player in the state of South Carolina. Talked to a staff member last week. David Turner is very, very high on this kid and was a target that Turner wanted. And Charles Powers of 24/7 sports offers this scouting report of Boone. Possesses an above average stature and frame for a strong side defensive end, has room to add mass once in a college strength program, and could ultimately grow into a defensive tackle nearing 300 pounds. Plays with physicality and aggression, stands out as an edge-setting run defender, has active hands at the point of attack with the ability to disengage via strength or quickness in moves, shows good effort and speed in chasing down plays in pursuit, productive as a junior, making a good number of plays behind the line of scrimmage, still progressing as a pass rusher, and will need to continue adding nuance to his game on that front. Projects as a Power 5 level starter with the upside of developing into a NFL draft pick. So, Will, you team him up with fellow top 100 defensive lineman, defensive end Tyreek Sapp. And for the second year in a row, the Gators are getting some beef in the trenches with some high favorable targets still on the board. But reading that scouting report there, and what I like to see from a high school player is setting the edge as a run defender. That's hard to me, especially in high school, and you're much better than everybody. You know, that part of a game takes a lot of discipline. You're not going out there and just trying to make big play after big play, and you know, over pursuing and helping the opposing offense out. That's just one little line there that I picked up on that I really liked hearing, more so than the always in the backfield or an aggressive type of player. You know, showing that discipline of being able to set the edge as a run defender is something I really like.
Yeah, I mean, I think the last guy that Florida recruited who had this sort of profile was Malik Langham, and he left the program after being part of the initial class with Mullen. So this is a position of need, a position that they really need to fill. You know, 2 years ago with Bogle and Summerall and Diabate, I think they've sort of filled what they need to do to get the pass rushing off the edge. And then even this past year with Antoine Powell being able to do that, and then adding guys like Lamar Goods and Gervon Dexter and Johnny Brown at defensive tackle. But what they haven't necessarily brought in is who's going to replace Zach Carter and some of those guys on the defensive end. And this is a guy who's going to be able to do that. You know, like you said, set the edge, not necessarily be the pass rusher, but be the guy who can occupy offensive linemen to allow the pass rushers to roam free. And that's really a big part of Grantham's 3-4 defense, is having linebackers who can be a significant threat to the quarterback because the defensive line is holding up in the run game. And we saw last year in some games where Florida struggled, an inability necessarily to set the edge, particularly the LSU game I'm thinking of. Now, obviously, Burrow had a lot to do with that, but Hilaire ran wild in that game. And if Florida could have stopped the running game of LSU, it would have made it a lot more difficult for Burrow. So guys like this are going to make it more difficult for the defense. And I think recruiting is important at all levels, but one of the places where I think it's become pretty clear that it's ultra, ultra important is the defensive line. And so Florida's building up there, and that's a great thing to see.
Now, another great thing to see, Will, is this list of players that are going to be on campus this week for the Gators. It's been quite some time since I've seen a list like this. I'll just quickly go through names here. I think a lot of this talk would be after the fact, the aftermath of this junior day coming up for the Gators. Some commits on campus, but a lot of high four-star, five-star talent that will be on the campus of Florida this week. Four-star quarterback Carlos Del Rio will be on campus, along with commit Breshard Smith, Dejon Reynolds as well there. So four-star wide receiver Braylon Brown, probably on visiting March 6th. Four-star wide receiver right here in Jacksonville, Marcus Burke. It looks right now to be a Florida-Georgia battle there. So Florida trying to make inroads there. Me being here in Jacksonville, I'll do what I can, Gator fans. But that's one big-time player to look out for. Also four-star wide receiver Romello Brinson. Gage Wilcox, commit, will be on campus as well. Another tight end that the Gators are looking good for right now is Nick Elsness, decommitted from Penn State earlier this week, also from here in Jacksonville at Episcopal High School. His head coach is Mark Brunell, former Jags quarterback. Worked with Brunell sometimes too. So if and when Elsness commits, some good analysts I'll be able to pull from Mark Brunell there. Five-star offensive tackle Amarius Mims will be on campus. Four-star offensive tackle Michael Morris. Two big targets for the Gators there along the offensive line. Javonte Gardner, a Florida commit, will also be on campus. Moving to the other side of the ball, weak side defensive end, outside linebacker Keanu Coate will be on campus as well. As long as, you know, big-time target here, Tamise Adeleye from IMG. Gators look really good for him right now. Big-time Tyreek Sapp, defensive lineman, of course. Keshawn Silver, another name to look out for. Maybe, you know, looking good for the Gators right now. Highly, highly ranked defensive lineman out of the state of North Carolina. Keshawn Silver will be on campus there this coming up weekend. Justice Boone will be a commit we just talked about, will be on campus. Kind of rounding this out, five-star defensive tackle Leonard Taylor. Big-time Gators target, looking good. Right now, Gators in good shape, along with some other schools there for him. Desmond Watson as well. You have Savion Collins, Corey Collier from the Miami Palmetto area. Collins committed to Miami. Collier, cornerback, safety there for from that area, will be on campus. Rounded out, five-star cornerback Jason Marshall, four-star cornerback Gator commit Clinton Burton, Kamara Wilcoxon as well, a Gator commit, and then Amari Harvey as well. So, Will, said many a time, four-star. This 2021 class for the Gators, you know, already ranked second in the nation, mostly due to how many commits they have now, but the talent level is rising, and looking good for a lot of the names I just ruled off there. Florida gets just a few of these guys, you know, and it really, I think, you know, sends a message out there that this 2021 class for the Gators may be the class that we just, when we look at Mullen's tenure, whenever that ends at Florida, the class that, you know, maybe everyone will point to and say, okay, there's that difference-making class, and because of players like these. And this weekend, so huge in making inroads for a lot of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think Mullen's been making steady progress on the recruiting trail. They've been getting better and better and better in terms of blue chip ratio, in terms of the overall average rating. One thing I will caution people on is last year's recruiting class had an average 24/7 rating of 90.7. This year's recruiting class right now, though it's ranked second, ranks 90.8. So the talent level of the guys that they already have committed, and they've got 13 guys, the talent level of those guys is very similar to what they had last year. Now, I mean, last year's class was a top 10 class, I think, wound up ranked eighth at the end of the day. So it's not like it's chopped liver or anything. But for comparison, Ohio State has 10 commits and the average commit ranking is 95.61. Clemson has 9 commits, the average ranking is 95.51. So that's really the class that Florida's trying to get into. So Texas 94.15, Oregon 92.33. So there are teams out there that have higher talent level profiles and just don't have as many commits. But this is Florida's opportunity, right, to impress those guys who are coming to campus, the guys that you listed off, and you get, you know, 3-5 stars to commit, and all of a sudden your ranking is going to be 95 real quick. So it doesn't take a whole lot of top 100 guys to shift the perception of your program, to shift the talent level of your program. And quite honestly, with the ability that Mullen has shown to deliver with guys who don't have that kind of talent profile, I'm excited to see what he can do when he does start bringing in guys with, you know, once Florida has Ohio State's level of talent with Dan Mullen at head coach, I'm excited to see what they can do.
Absolutely, absolutely. So big, big time visit list this weekend. Hopefully, we're talking about, you know, one, two, three, few of these guys next week, as you know, really looking good for Florida, maybe a commit or two as well. So Gators need to put themselves in, probably will be in good shape here after this weekend as far as recruiting goes, and all the big names that would be on campus and a chance to make an impression on a lot of those guys making a return visit, some guys on campus for the first time. A really good shot here for the Gators to inject the talent level with a lot of those guys on that list. So, Will, as you mentioned earlier, of course, you put out your latest at the Reading and Reaction today, detailing Kyle Trask and maybe the next step in this offense. Anything else you want to hit about that or what you got coming up? You're on vacation next week, right?
Well, sort of. So I have a talk to give for my real job down in Orlando, which means my daughter is on vacation with my parents down at Disney while I'm doing real work.
Not a vacation for you.
But yeah, so I wrote about Kyle Trask and what kind of improvements he can take moving forward. We've hit on a lot of it today, but there's a lot we didn't hit on in terms of there was some film stuff that I looked at in there. So certainly go take a look. Let me know what you think and sort of my expectations for what I'm expecting to see out of him in 2020 and what that means for Florida. I think there are some specific things that you can take from the trends that you see at what defenses that were successful against him. There's a very clear pattern about what they did, and he's either going to have to figure out a way to overcome what made him struggle last year, or Florida as an offense is going to have to figure out a way to overcome that. And so that's really what the article is about. And then later on this week, Nick is supposed to be back with a follow-up on the Charlie Pell era. He's got like seven different articles in the series he's working on, but he's working hard to get some good interviews for people from that era. So I'm excited to see what he's going to have coming out next, hopefully later this week.
All right. And that is over at readandreaction.com. You can check out Will's work there. You can follow Will on Twitter at WillMilesSEC. I'm the host of Gators Breakdown, David Waters. You can find me on Twitter at GatorDave_SEC. Guys and girls out there, thanks for listening to this episode of Gators Breakdown.